Hello and welcome to this recording of a session from our recent Future of London event. I'm Damien Wilde. I say this of all of our sessions, of course, but you've chosen wisely tuning into this one. There's no better authority on London, its politics, its demographics, and its direction of travel than Tony Travers. I've been talking to Tony about these trends for, frighteningly, 25 years now, and the conversations are always fascinating and always fresh. Clearly, mid-COVID, a lot of the conversation focuses on risk. Principally, that London loses its soft power, that it becomes more like Los Angeles with no real centre, and that its public transport infrastructure contracts. But Tony retains his optimism too, as should we all. London could become a bigger city, he says, a younger city, but it will almost certainly be a changed city. Hello, I'm Damien Wilde and welcome to EG's Future of London event, a series of sessions broadcast throughout October, focusing on key challenges facing the city and this sector. We've teamed up with the London Real Estate Forum to address those headline challenges in a series of virtual interviews and debates with some of London's most expert voices from real estate and beyond. And there is none more expert on London than our guest today, Tony Travers, Director of LSE London and much more besides at the university. His expertise is frequently sought by policymakers and he has advised a range of select committees and think tanks. He's also the author of several books, most recently London Boroughs at 50. Tony, thanks for joining us for this kickoff session. So London is in a tough place, isn't it? Politically, economically, and geographically, the balance of power seems to be shifting, and that was perhaps a direction of travel in some respects, even before COVID struck. Where's it heading?
Well, there's no question, you're right, that even in advance of COVID-19, the challenges of the government's levelling up agenda could easily be interpreted, and regularly were interpreted, as anti-London rather than pro other places. So that's, I think, part of the backdrop. And to that, you can add the current politics where, you know, we're now in the middle of a 2-year-long mayoral election campaign with a Labour mayor seeking re-office with a Conservative government in power. That dynamic is not the easiest, I think it's fair to say. But most particularly, COVID-19 has now come along and has had a greater effect on city centres, particularly London as Britain's biggest city centre, than any other part of the country. And the big issue now is, will that create a longer term embedded change in the economy of the city, and therefore, along with other big cities of the country?
And as you sit there and review this, and you know that 2-year mayoral election campaign, which has always been a distraction when it happens for a long-term sector like real estate, but there's a different dynamic politically, isn't there, as you alluded to, where there is a real clash between City Hall and Whitehall and Westminster, and the mayor's devolved powers. Always discussion about there not being enough there. They seem to be further constrained through the transport settlement.
That's right. I mean, one of the consequences of COVID-19 has been that in the initial phase of it, in the initial lockdown, you know, tube and commuter rail, indeed all rail, transport use dropped by 95% and bus use by 85 to 90%. That led to a massive drop in fare income, which in turn means the Mayor of London and the commuter rail, the national railways, have had to go to the government for bailouts. And in delivering the bailout to London, the government has insisted on conditions, including observers on the Transport for London board, made London pay for some of the costs of the fare loss through borrowing and therefore future payments. So it's allowed government to extend its influence and control over the Mayor of London. And by the way, anybody who's looked at the recent proposals on the planning system and the planning white paper will note that the document about the long-term future of the planning system doesn't mention the Mayor of London from end to end, other than indirectly. So, you know, there's a question there about the whole future of devolution. And by the way, it looks as if devolution more generally in England is going to get pushed into, you know, there's not going to be a consultative document later this year. It'll all be pushed off into next year, perhaps.
So centralisation, planning changes that reinforce that perhaps, and
Is there an opportunity, or is it happening already that the boroughs can work more effectively together, or is it difficult in the face of some of those other political challenges?
I think the boroughs, who, like the Mayor of London, live in a centralised system, like all councils in England and separately Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, live in a world where they rely on central government for resources, particularly short-term resources because of COVID-19. I think the London boroughs, like all councils, have to have a good relationship with national government. And it's easy for them in some ways when it comes to housing finance or any other kind of power to look to Whitehall round the edges of City Hall. So the boroughs, I think, which are directly elected, have their own planning and other powers, see themselves as almost equals to City Hall. And therefore, they have their own sovereignty and autonomous view. And that has always been the case, probably a bit more so now.
OK, well, those are some of the political challenges. I don't just want to dwell on the politics. I do want to come back to the geography and how London might change shape or emphasis, at least. But I wonder about the economic impact. And there's a report out very recently from ARUP, commissioned by Heart of London Business Alliance, and I think you were involved in that, warning about a devastating impact on the arts and culture sector. We can see it in leisure and hospitality as well. I wonder how London bounces back from that, and whether the V-shaped recovery for the city and in perhaps in those sectors that we'd hoped for isn't realistic anymore.
Well, I mean, to use a kind of cliche, or it soon will be a cliche, social distancing is the enemy of agglomeration. And agglomeration is how big cities prosper and thrive, people being near each other, going to theatres, using public transport, being in the streets, and. So there's no question that, given that in London, 1.25 million people came into central London between 7 a.m. and 10 a.m. as recently as January or even February this year, before COVID struck. And we're nowhere near getting back to those kind of figures. And if there isn't a return to work, if working from home and shopping in the neighbourhood and all of these things embed changes to the economy, then it's hard to see the central London, or for that matter, the downtown New York economy ever being for some while quite the same thing in the short to medium term future.
That's quite hard to think through, isn't it? Because that leaves a hollowed out centre, a donut, which we've talked about, but we hadn't talked about it previously, it being at the expense of the whole. It was about levelling up the outer boroughs, perhaps. If that happens, what happens to central London?
Well, I think the way you put the question is spot on. I think policymakers find these issues, quite a lot of issues actually, because the whole economy is about to change. One of the intriguing things about Rishi Sunak's recent statement was he signalled that the economy in the United Kingdom is going to change structurally. That is, things are going to die and other things are going to grow, he hopes, and that the economy will be different in future. Now, buried in that idea, of course, is if city centres, and London in particular, were to alter radically, then it will have effects on things that go beyond central London. Most obviously, the theatre and public transport and civil aviation to take. But let's take the first two. 60% of all theatre box office in the United Kingdom was in the West End. Okay, so if central London can't recover, it's hard to see how the theatre would fully recover. And that means British theatre and soft power would be affected, however you look at it, that's an inevitable consequence. Similarly, 60% of all railway journeys in the United Kingdom begin and end in London. And if central London no longer is a hub of transport in the way it once was, that will affect national railways, I suspect. And we will have to see discussions, the Treasury will eventually demand this, about reducing rail services and perhaps mothballing parts of systems, not only in London. And that has implications, because actually, if you follow that through, it means more car journeys which is not where public policy was headed till quite recently. Now, we'll get some discussion of the 15-minute city. All I'd say is the current public transport system, particularly in London, was not necessarily brilliantly set up to deliver such current public policy desires.
And that 15-minute city, does it, perhaps, you know, 6 months ago when we were having that discussion, 7-8 months ago, we thought of that as, you know, would it be realistic for many people to live within 15 minutes of central London? But now we're talking about 15 minutes in Enfield, in Croydon, in all of those places, which changes the shape and emphasis pretty profoundly. But I do wonder about that change. And you used a phrase that was quite powerful recently, which I hope I can say first time, the Los Angelesification.
There it is.
The Los Angelesification of the city. Do you see that if these other trends progress as inevitable for London?
Well, the reason I've begun to wonder about this is that at the moment, the sum total of policy at the national citywide, certainly the national citywide levels, is kind of to wait and see what happens, what falls out of all this, how many people end up working at home part or all of the time, how many people decide to move their homes from inner London to Kent or to Hertfordshire or whatever, all these things that you see some elements of being discussed in the press day by day. So it's impossible to know at the moment how much of this is real and how much of this will stick permanently. There are separate stories about, you know, Google extending its investment at King's Cross and so on, other property companies showing their long-term confidence in central London. But my concern is that if we just sort of allow things to happen and, you know, with no sign that COVID is going to go away. You know, I think, you know, if we're being sort of careful here, I think it would probably be sensible for businesses and others to assume COVID and its implications will be around at least till the end of 2021, could be into 2022 before we get back to whatever the new normal is. Now, against that backdrop, if there's a dispersal of city of economic activity from central London, it will most likely be to outer London and the area around in the inner area around in the southeast and the east, but around London, which was the normal pattern of out-migration, by the way. Now, if you couple this sort of economic change with some of Robert Jenrick's proposed planning reforms and housing numbers, you begin to see the creation of a more sprawling London. So London would still be a kind of city of, you know, 8 or 9 million in a region of 21 or 22 million, but some of the economic activity will have moved outwards. And in some looked at another way, London will become an even bigger city in the medium term than it has been. It's just that more of it will be spread further out. People will be commuting in and out of the city centre, driving around the M25 to meetings rather than using public transport. Now, public policy could stop that, but at the moment, there's very little discussion of it.
Very interesting. And it's clear that, you know, where we had a plan A previously and then perhaps a plan B, and I'm thinking of retail space, retail jobs, as they began to contract, they became leisure, hospitality jobs, entertainment. We need plan C, D and E, don't we? And it doesn't feel like plan B is getting enough attention at the moment.
And of course, buried in, you know, I might be wrong, by the way, but if there were this sort of Los Angelesification of London, so I mean, in some ways, it could be good for outer London boroughs. Let's not pretend there are places, you know, these sort of 1930s parades in a number of boroughs. There are town centres, all of which would actually capture more retail activity. More people would eat out there in the evening. It could strengthen some of the outer London boroughs' economies. What we don't know is what the overall productivity of London and the wider southeast would be, and therefore the UK economy would be, in such an environment. But one thing I am certain about is that if there is a sort of move away of economic activity and affluent residents from the central and inner part of the city, then it will have a number of effects, one of which, as I already hinted at, would be a kind of, in a sense, a further growth of London and a demand for more housing in the Greenbelt and so on. And secondly, it would risk some of the inner parts of the city, and Los Angeles, of course, is a very awkward comparison here because it, you know, what's happened there in the past, it would leave some parts of inner London where lower income households can't afford to move out and would be left in the city. Now, question, would there be as much economic activity there, or would it have all have gone to Guildford, Milton Keynes, Southend and Brighton? Well, you know, we'll, and indeed the countryside. So these are major public policy issues, which for the time being, I don't see any national or citywide or indeed local politicians really beginning to engage with, though they will have to, I think.
And lastly, do you remain an optimist, even if it is a little longer term than perhaps shorter term?
Oh, I am an optimist in the, you know, in the 20-30 year time frame. I mean, London's had its ups and downs. In fact, if you look back, you know, London started as a very densely populated city in the City of London. Then the railways came, allowing a massive sprawl outwards and growth, and particularly, you know, in the 19th century and then in the interwar period between 1918 and 39. And then a sort of emptying out of inner and central London with deindustrialization in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, followed by a re-centralization since 1986. Question, are we going to see a further push out into the wider southeast and outer London? And that, as I say, may sound problematic for central London, but it would mean in the long term that London became an even bigger thing. That's not necessarily helpful for the rest of the UK in levelling up, by the way. And in that longer term, central London could then reassert itself in part of an even bigger city. History suggests central London is always resilient, even if it has difficult shorter term periods.
And I suppose there's an at least this is a challenge faced by every world city right now.
It very much is. I mean, I think that particularly for London and New York and Paris as major world cities, they all have this problem with, you know, the need to balance public health against the needs of the economy, which we all kind of understand. Though I do think Paris and New York have a slight advantage over London because the density of population near the city centre is greater in those two cities than London. London is famously a more Los Angeles and spread out city. Of course, in places like Hong Kong and Singapore, they're city states, so they can't really spread out. They're stuck with the city they've got. And then you've got the new models of urbanization in China based on developing cities, which I doubt are somehow going to go into reverse. So I think there's an issue of soft power for the UK government in all of this. So the question for them is, do you want London to be a major world city with all the things, particularly post-Brexit, that it offered to, you know, the world as a symbol of the United Kingdom? Or do you want to risk other cities in other countries stealing a march on this very visible symbol of Britain's economic, political and social and indeed cultural power? That, again, is definitely one for national government politicians to think long and hard about.
Tony, we'll have to leave it there. Fascinating as ever. So much to talk about and to think about. And we will be talking and thinking about those in other sessions during the course of this Future of London series. But Tony, thank you for kicking off things superbly there.
Thanks, Damien. Bye.
I told you it was good. Thanks to Tony and thank you for listening. To keep up with all the latest news, views, analysis and research that the EG Group has to provide, sign up to all our property podcasts and subscribe to Radius Data Exchange for unlimited access to our content and comprehensive commercial real estate data. And do listen and watch EG's other Future of London events. Each session has insights you need to hear.